Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Naughton. I'd like to welcome you to this program. You are listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. This is a little different program in that we take a very serious subject that generally is not discussed by the mainstream media, invite individuals on who have unique insights. This is also a continuation of our series of conversations with remarkable minds. The issue today: what will it take for us to finally acknowledge that only through spiritual activism can we change anything in a positive way? All the time we see people who are trying to protest something. Look at the Occupy movement. I was there from day one. And as I approached one of the young people, and you can actually watch this conversation on Gary Naughton TV, I said, what do you oppose? No, or corporatization, globalization, you know, the power of the 1%. All right. How did the 1% become 1%? Well, because they're greedy and they know how to work the political system. Fair enough. How serious are you? Well, I'm from a major university in New Jersey, Rutgers University. I've committed myself to being here. However long it is, that's what I'm going to do. Good for you. So you would say that it is a sense of idealism that brings you here? Absolutely. Okay. I just have some questions. You're wearing designer jeans. You're wearing a designer shirt. You've got Nike sneakers. You've got a McDonald's there sitting beside you in a bag. If we looked in your wallet, would we see credit cards from Chase, American, Bank America? Would we see that you're giving your money into these major globalizing one percenters? And then I pulled over my shirt. I said, you see that? My shirt's made in the USA, as are my clothes. I eat organic and local. My money's not their banks. I don't vote for them. I'll only vote for a qualified third-party populist person. Otherwise, I would be wasting my vote. Even if we don't win, we must understand that we are making a statement about what we feel is important. Now go through anything that you're doing that shows me that you're truly actualizing against the 1%. And instead, all you see is the person got very angry that I should point out these contradictions between what a person says and what they actually do. And then I went on to have a discussion about how we don't have a 1%. We have more likely 70-30%, 30% of the people and who are in control of everything, and who are they? And he wasn't aware that we have 9 million millionaires in the United States. At that time, maybe today, a little less. And we have a lot of people who you'll never see at a demonstration, the professional class. You'll never see the rich at these demonstrations, with rare exception. And most celebrities wouldn't jeopardize how they earn their income by alienating people. A few have the courage to do so. So we're going to talk about that with my guest tonight. My guest is Andrew Harvey. He's an internationally renowned religious scholar, a teacher. He's authored over 30 books. He is the founder of the Institute of Sacred Activism, which is an international organization dedicated to inspiring people to become more involved in challenging our global crises and to commit themselves to peace and sustainability. Andrew was born in India. He studied at Oxford University, where he was a fellow at All Souls College. He taught at Oxford University, he taught at Cornell University, and he taught at the California Institute for Integral Studies. He is perhaps best known for having explored all the different religions in depth, particularly Buddhism, Christianity, Hinduism, and Sufism, and interpret them in a passionate manner that preserves their meaning and significance for our time. He received many awards for his writings, including the Benjamin Franklin Award. His most recent book is Radical Passion, Sacred Love and Wisdom in Action. And before that, The Hope, which won the Nautilus Silver Award for Social Change. Nice to have you back with us, Andrew.
Great to be here. Wonderful subject.
Before we speak about some of the problems we're facing corporate liberalism and corporate conservatism, and then by extension, the corporate Democrats, corporate Republicans, and the Occupy movement, and the Arab Spring movement, and the European Springs that are occurring now, erupting around the world, and look at why most have failed, particularly our own Occupy movement. I want to begin with an expression you shared recently on my program when you were discussing something of interest. And since we'll be touching upon spiritual topics and trying to explore the spiritual meaning behind events in our midst, I felt we should get to this question first off. That concerns the role of our emotions in the particular role of anger and how it is necessary for speaking truth to power and also to infuse our social, political, and environmental activism with spiritual purpose. And you spoke of sacred outrage. So please begin with describing this and its role in activism. And then I'd like you to describe how sacred outrage is different than emotional anger that is fueled with religious meaning. For example, there are fundamentalist Christians today who are furious with anything related to Islam and see our invasions in the Middle East in religiously charged symbolism as a crusade. And there are people who would prefer to interpret Jesus or Muhammad as warriors first and then deny their messages of universal love and peacekeeping altogether. So what is the difference between what you call a sacred outrage and then just religiously charged anger? And then how do we know which one we are being possessed with when we wish to become active in a social or political cause? The forum is yours.
These are very, very profound questions. I think sacred outrage is the necessary and totally human and actually profoundly spiritual and divine reaction of an open heart to violations of essential law, violations of compassion, violations of dignity, violations of individual rights. And it's sacred because the heart seeing this violation will not rest in passivity, but demands a transformation of the circumstances that causes these terrible derelictions and violations of essential rights. I think the problem of how to use this sacred outrage is also a very profound one. It's quite clear that the patriarchal religions and the patriarchal mystical systems have demonized anger and have demonized sacred outrage in favor of a vision of enlightenment as serenity and peace in the middle of whatever happens, in the favor of a vision of enlightenment as a drowning in transcendent truth rather than, as I believe it truly is, an embodied presence of truth that is prepared to react to what is destroying the planet. So the patriarchal systems have demonized anger, and there are certain kinds of revolutionary rhetoric that divinize anger, make it absolutely the core energy, and you can see this in the French Revolution, you can see this in the Russian Revolution, you can see this in certain forms of Black Pantherhood, for example. What I'm talking about is neither the demonization nor the divinization of anger, but the facing of the outrage that is being committed, the rising up of a sacred force of fiery outrage within you as a natural response to that, as a divine response to that, and then the working with that sacred outrage in a very, very mature way so as to be able not to be mastered by it, but to master it so it becomes a source of fierce compassion energy, a source of stamina, a source of perpetual focus on a problem that causes you radical heartbreak. And this energy of fierce compassion is essential for the revolution that now must happen, I believe, and that is a revolution of grassroots love in action, a revolution of sacred activism. Because without this transmuted sacred outrage, without this fire of focused, compassionate passion energy, we're simply not going to have the chutzpah and the force and the stamina and the power and the intensity and the radiance of being and the courage to go forward in the face of the overwhelming difficulties that now threaten the whole human experiment. What needs to be done to separate sacred outrage from neurotic fear and anger is nothing less than two things. First, extensive inner shadow work. You really do have to look at the way in which your childhood wounds, your social conditioning, your religious wounds, the wounds of Western culture and decline have marked you in certain ways and made you open to certain kinds of rage that are founded not in a glowing, healthy, divine response to injustice, but in a turbid and morbid, self-absorbed replaying of your own traumas. You have to look at that, and you have to really make a triage at the bottom of yourself between the things in you that just react from your inherited traumatic past and the things in you that react from your deep conscience, your divine awareness. And that can be done through patient shadow work. And the other way in which separating from sacred outrage from authentic passion energy can be done is in direct tantric divine practice. And this is very, very important for all activists, I think, and I teach this all over the world. I was taught it myself by a wonderful old woman in Benares who said, look, you cannot suppress your anger and you cannot allow it to master you. What you need to do is to transform its force into a deathless energy of divine love in action. This is how you do it. When you find this outrage rising in you at something, imagine that you're standing in front of Kali, the queen of destruction and creation, the dark feminine, the force of majestic, destructive, compassionate, ferocious passion energy, the essential force of the dark feminine. And she appears in front of you, and you have a direct connection with her, looking into her eyes. And then you imagine her belly opening, and it's a furnace, her belly. She shows you this furnace that is her belly. And then you open your own chest. You imagine your own chest opening, and the outrage coming from you out of the depths of yourself as a lava flow that is half gold and half dark. The golden part of that lava flow is the divine conscious in you reacting with sacred outrage to violation. The dark part is the neurotic part that may come from your own traumas, your own fears, your own disillusioned human beings. And you allow that entire force to arise from the depths of yourself and to be taken into the depths of the furnace of the Kali being in front of you, and to be transmuted there. And she opens the furnace again, and what streams from it is a torrent of gold, power, and fire that is the transmuted force of sacred outrage and is the real compassion, passion energy that then sustain your activism, your sacred activism, for years and years and years and never run dry. And this is a magnificent way of not suppressing and not overexpressing, but of transmuting. That's the key.
I appreciate those insights. Thank you.
How do you react to what I said? Does it seem, what is it, what seemed right in it to you? What seemed real in it?
Well, all of it is symbolic of a universal force. I don't break that force into multiple forces. It's like there's 365 primary meridians.
Right.
I only see one meridian. As a person,
many expressions of that one meridian, yes.
Okay, so I don't confuse the issue of the essence of life with how many different variables we can splinter from that, how many ways we can use that energy. And I think if we need to ground in myth, if we have to ground in allegory, if we have to ground in religious context, let us do so. That brings me to my second issue. It segues into this because I was very concerned that I wouldn't have time, and indeed I do not have time, to address the challenge between the liberal establishment and the conservative establishment and what so many people are doing based upon being guided, motivated, manipulated by either the official Democrat or official liberal establishment and all their spokespersons. And I'm talking about from the Democracy Now on the left and Rachel Maddow and all the people on MSNBC and all the people on the right. So I'm not going to read that commentary I wrote. It'll be tomorrow because it's too long. However, I believe that liberalism today has betrayed its roots and mission and ultimate goals and needs to be replaced with a more enlightened vision of the future. And in some ways, I see the true spirit of liberalism having been born during the Enlightenment and to uphold liberal causes for the sacredness of all people and races and genders and the miracle of life in large part emerged from scientific thinking and the scientific contemplation of the world and society around us. And it was a great departure from the earlier mythological view that saw human conditions as divinely predetermined, and therefore there was no point in exerting effort to uplift the downtrodden because you'd be interfering with God's will, and it's just best to deal with your own redemption. Well, the Enlightenment gave birth to the dialogue between religion, mysticism, and science. And I think William James, I could use other examples, but I would hold him up as an excellent early example of that.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I'm not sure if you have any thoughts about this, but where do you feel liberalism and that liberal agenda that supported human and civil rights and worker conditions and education for all and social welfare and anti-war efforts ceased to be spiritual? And as a consequence, what has liberalism become today and what is necessary to replace it and revive the spirit of its original mission and causes?
Well, one of the books I think everybody should read is Chris Hedges' Death of the Liberal Class. It's a very tough and frightening read, but it's an essential read for every adult, I think, on the planet, because what Chris is saying in that book is that liberalism in general is totally inadequate to the tragic, chaotic, desperate nature of our crisis because it lacks a tragic sense of reality and fundamentally resides still in the shadow of the Enlightenment legacy, which is that we progress endlessly and that with a little bit of enlightened thought, everybody will be transformed and choose the right, which is a total fantasy in face of the enormous power of the shadow and the enormous destructive urges within the human and also within the cosmos itself. So liberalism could be said to be a superficial and inadequate response to the agony of the tragedy of human evolution at this particular moment in the crisis. That's the first point. The second point is even more serious, and that is that those people who believe themselves to be liberals, to be champions of the poor, of justice, of equality, of peace, have shown themselves over the last 20 years to be absolutely inadequate to the challenge of halting the corporate march to total control. What did the liberals do to try fundamentally to stop the Iraqi war? There were a few protests. They happened. They dwindled. What did the liberals do to get the Patriot Act revoked? What did the liberals do when none of the major players in Wall Street scandal got payment for their crimes? None of them. What did the liberals do when the Supreme Court brought in the United Citizens Act, which makes it possible for corporations to be considered as people and therefore to have the rights of people in dominating political discourse, fundamentally selling democracy to the highest bidder? Liberals have spectacularly given up on their major causes, and they've spectacularly given up on the passion to put their deep feelings into radical political action, which has left the whole political field of America open to corporate management and design, which is a terrible dereliction of the fundamental liberal cause. and a terrible sign of the decadence of the American middle and upper class.
What you just said reminds me of Paul Tillich when he said the passion for truth is silenced by answers which have the weight of undisputed authority. That today we are motivated not by the truth in a statement, by in the illusion that the person giving us that message is the truth bearer. Wasn't it I.F. Stone who said every emancipation has in its seeds a new slavery and every truth easily becomes a lie?
Yes.
Look at President Clinton. He betrayed the entire concept of liberalism and took it in a direction that was so perverse and so decadent and so narcissistic.
And so attuned to the corporations. And, of course, America delighted because it secured a brief period of prosperity, and everybody enjoyed the prosperity but didn't notice the successive betrayals and didn't care about them.
You're right, because the average person who was involved in that upper mobile projection, the people, my generation, the baby boomers in the United States, we had a very stable and much more humane way of respecting the rights of people to have an honored life from about the mid-40s to about the mid-70s. And people who were the head of industries and people who were our leaders were in no small measure, they were given credit for maintaining a social stability and a social contract. It had been fought for by the unions. It had been fought for by the feminist and civil rights movements and the humanistic movements. But we actually had something. And we had something where a person could work their whole life within an industry and know that they would have a certain quality of life if they live with some meaning.
Right.
And then along came five men: T-Bone Pickens, Ivan Botsky, Michael Milken, Saul Steinberg, and Carl Icahn. And they said, why in the world should we care about a society or a company or a 100, 200-year-old company that's employed generation after generation from the same family and been the anchor for stability in this whole region, this town, this state? Why can't we just exploit the resources for ourselves to maximize our profit? And that's exactly when junk bonds came. That's when the green mailing came. That's when the corporate raiders came that later cleaned up their image. And now we call them equity partnerships. Yet that became the turning point,
right,
where a whole generation came out of college and says, why should I go to work and end up in the Peter Principle of getting up to the highest level of my own incompetency and becoming invisible in the fog of corporatocracy? Why can't I just own the business? Why can't I do in 1 year what Andrew Carnegie or the Rockefellers would take 10 years and all their wealth to do? And that's exactly what happened. Young, very smart, very aggressive, legions of baby boomers took advantage of a system and completely changed it and altered it. So no longer was liberal or conservative having any meaning. The word spirituality never existed. Pop it up. Talk about that in relationship to what Chris Hedges, by the way, who's taken a lot of heat from the left, because how dare you talk about liberals? Well, how dare they not be honest when they look in a mirror to see how they have an empty vessel? They have expunged their spiritual nature so they could not feel guilt at contemplating how much greed was in their own lives and how that greed infected people. Wasn't it William Blake who said, a truth that's told with bad intentions beats all the lies you can invent?
I think that you're talking about something that is very, very, very difficult to exaggerate, which is the dereliction of the left and of the liberals, because they have simply annihilated their sacred connection. And without a fundamental sacred connection to the divine, however you experience it, without an understanding of our unity with all being, without being fed by the deepest springs of inner peace and inner knowledge and inner wisdom, there is going to be absolutely no movement against the death machine. We need need a worldwide activist movement grounded in universal, mystical, and spiritual principles, fed by the strength that can only come from those principles, because what we need to face is that the corporations are bottomlessly corrupt. The politicians in the pay of the corporations are either bottomlessly corrupt or hampered. The systems now in place are suicidal and matricidal and heading for a cliff of extinction. And that we are being terrorized by fear and by manipulation by a media entirely in control. Almost entirely in control of the corporations. And we must realize that all of the old parties, all of the old separations between right and left are meaningless in the face of an evolutionary crisis which is exploding everywhere and which now threatens our extinction and the extinction of a great deal of nature. And we must realize, too, that we're not going to avoid the collapse of industrial civilization. It's much too late to stop. It's much too late to prevent. We are headed for the complete unraveling of our complete agenda, our complete culture. And it is going to be more horrific than anything that we've ever lived through, more dangerous, and also more replete with astonishing opportunities for recreation, reimagining, reinventing our world. But those opportunities will have to be taken only by those who are truly strong enough to get through this next period, truly strong enough to see the truth of what's happening, truly strong enough to sustain bearing that truth, truly strong enough because grounded in divine reality, grounded in spiritual practice, to come together with others to create a sustainable, long-term, brave movement that can actually start bringing in the kinds of values that will not be able to reverse collapse, but will be able to seed the kinds of structures that are needed to thrive, to have a chance of thriving through the biggest hurricane of our history. That's how I see where we are. And I see the right as bankrupt. I see the left as bankrupt. I see the liberals as in La La Land. I see the New Age as utterly depraved by its diabetic mysticism. I see very, very few people staring into the face of the truth and then doing what the truth of our situation now demands, which is going in very much deeper so as to be able to risk going out very much further and very much more radically to try and stop the death machine destroying the planet and the human race very soon.
Good. Let's look now.
Is that clear enough?
That's very clear.
I think that we very few people are prepared to have a conversation. That's one of the many reasons I admire Chris Hedges very much, because he is unafraid to expose the bankruptcy, the hypocrisy, the vanity, the liberty-gibbetedness, the superficiality of all of the mental healings proposed for this crisis. None of the solutions out of the current consciousness that we are in are going to have a hope in hell of dealing with this crisis. We have to be at a far more embodied level of awakening and far more focused and far more realistic about the real danger that is really now threatening us, for us to have a hope in hell of getting through the next 10 years without being completely shattered and reduced to madness.
I'm going to give you a list of problems that I see, and I would like for you to give us your insight, your intuitive spiritual insight, what you see people could do who are conscious and connected and are wanting to do the right thing. And then I want you to share, for those who choose not to believe in any of this, what the likely outcome is to be, all right? Global change in climate, which will manifest from the heating of the planet, but also we're going to have our shoreline substantially eroded with major surges. And that's what happens when water heats and it's heating. And now we were just informed today that the Great Siberian permafrost is thawing. And that means that you could have upwards of 27% of the entire CO2 heating from methane released because of that. So that's going to warm up the air even more. Also, the Arctic is going to be ice-free shortly, and that's going to end up heating up the bottom of the Arctic, which is very shallow at 500 feet. That's going to cause more warming. We're going to have worse hurricanes. We will have it where it's normal to have a Category 3, 4, or 5 hit the East Coast. We're going to have major flooding in all the major cities that counts for about 56 million people on the East Coast alone. It's very highly probable that we'll get hit with at least one and possibly more 15 to 20x solar storms. A earthquake is highly likely. Drought will now become permanent in 16 states. And now we were just told last week in an official report from the National Oceanic Group that we're about to enter a 1,000-year drought. There hasn't been a drought like that since the mid-12th century. And it'll be so bad that you simply will not be able to grow anything in the middle western states and many of the southern states. Now, that's on the water is acidifying. 80% of the major fish are gone. That when you acidify the water, you're going to see the rest of the fish go. Dead zones, now there are over 400 dead zones. One of the largest is right at the base of the Mississippi because of artificial fertilizer. So the environment and its impact, and we as a nation doing absolutely nothing to change our lifestyle or demand political action from the left to the right. That's one major issue. Second major issue.
Well, it's the major issue, let's face it. Without that address being addressed, what are the other issues really about? This is the major issue. It's our whole livelihood. We're suicidal.
Okay, then let's start with that and take that one on, all right?
The three things that everybody needs to do. The first is to really take in what you've just said and really, really take it in such a way that you feel it at the most primordial level, which is that your heart shatters. You cannot escape that shattering. And it is essential, I think, to embrace that shattering, because that shattering is the one thing that has a chance of making you real in this crisis. And the only way you can, I think, in my experience, face such a shattering is to be grounded in some kind of deep understanding and experience of the divine, however you describe it. Because when you really see how mad we are and how terrible what we're doing is and how dangerous it is and how it's exploding right now and how little we're doing to it, everything that you've been avoiding all your life will come up in you, your terror, your rage, your disillusion at human beings, self-loathing, impotence, terrible fear, dread, and you are going to have to be able to be strong enough to sustain that. And only those, I believe, who are grounded in spiritual practice can possibly do that. So for God's sake, get a deep spiritual practice that means something to you and start doing it so that you can stay steady as this huge rending continues. That's the first thing. The second thing is to really see that there is absolutely no hope for controlling climate change in any way through any of the existing channels, political, social, corporate, or any other way. The corporations are not going to change. The energy corporations are going to go on strip mining the world for the last profits, knowing fully well that they are destroying the planet. They are run by people who are lucid psychotics of great brilliance and lethal, horrible persistence. They're not going to stop destroying the planet. And the corporations have total control of the political systems, so there's not going to be any solution within in any existing political system that's going to act on behalf of the human race, on behalf of nature, on behalf of ordinary people, on behalf of the poisoned waters, to stop the energy companies continuing to devastate the planet with enormous profit. So what you have to see is that what is needed now is the force that upseated the British Empire, the force that brought racism to its knees in the 60s under Martin Luther King, the force that propelled Solidarność, the force that gave Aung San Suu Kyi the courage to endure those years of silent enclosure in her home waiting for tide to turn, the force that sustains the heroic sacred activism of the Dalai Lama, the force of embodied nonviolent love in action, and that this has got to be a worldwide movement, very much more sophisticated, very much more spiritually awake, very much more trained and honed than anything that Occupy could produce or the Arab Spring, because our last and best hope is in a worldwide grassroots revolution of love in action that says this energy policy and the structures of society that it contains have to go, and we have to end them, because our one hope of surviving at all in any kind of grace is allowing the system to collapse now. It has to collapse now, and we have to start rebuilding from it now, because if it continues, we are truly destroyed. If it collapses, we will go through some terrible times, but we will have a chance of having a half or a quarter inhabitable world for the human race to continue. The third thing that is really important, I think, for people to face is that this is going to be a very difficult thing to get going, this grassroots revolution of love in action, because we have all been so destroyed inwardly by the consumerism, by the cruelty, by the stupidity and superficiality and appalling boredom of the culture that we have been reared in. We've all been made at some deep levels impotent and jaded and cynical and deeply scared by the growing authoritarianism which we continue to deny. And so that's going to require from us a massive and unprecedented act of courage, really something that we've never seen in our history. And it's my still abiding hope that we will reach for that, but the days are running out.
You have taught in many of the most esteemed universities in the world. What is your opinion of the role that the younger college generation should be playing in this, and do you feel that they are equipped emotionally and spiritually at this time, coming from a very vacuous baby boomer parenting group that was more interested in giving their children possessions and buying love and private nannies than grounding them in the real nature of life? Do you see them able to be a part of and even leading this renaissance?
Well, I think that I have met some very extraordinary younger people who really do know where we are and who are very brave and who are also aware of the deep need for a contemplative foundation for their action, because they know that they're in for the long haul and they know that they're going to need sources of strength and courage and peace and calm and wisdom that are simply not accessible in the consciousness that's being offered to them by their culture or by this adoration of science. I have met those people, and they're very extraordinary people, and they're doing great work in homelessness, they're doing work in the environment, they're doing work in Africa. And whenever I do meet them, I see in their faces the possibility of a new human dawn, because they have three characteristics that seem to be very important to me. First of all, they're very often extremely integrated emotionally and sexually. They've not got the homophobia or the misogyny of previous generations, so there is a generous health about them. Secondly, they truly have these few young people that I've met, a very scalding sense of both the hollowness of the right and the hollowness of the left, and they're truly concerned to create a new possibility. Thirdly, they really do believe in the spirit and the power of the divine to transform this situation, and they have a very deep practical grounding in an indigenous reality. They really do revere nature and organic farming and living closer to the land. I've met these people. They're here. But the other truth is that there are far, far too few of them as yet, because the majority of the young people that I also meet have been brutalized by this consumer culture, turned into ADD addicts of iPads and Facebook and Twitter, and seem constitutionally incapable of reading a book, have hardly any cultural memory, and really believe that the revolution of this culture can be secured by turning up and protesting from time to time and making colorful remarks without really training for a long-haul, deep, nonviolent, spiritual, transformatory movement. So their vision on every level is superficial, and they have no help at all. My hope is in the growth of those young people that I know who really have woken up, and in them being supported by the elders, such as myself, and in them really being coming together to be able to force a coherent vision through. But this is going to be very, very difficult, and I salute them. How do you feel?
I feel that the vast majority of the young people today have been indoctrinated into a commodified social contract.
Yes, exactly.
Where everything is to be objectified by its price.
Value. Yeah.
So we know the price of everything and the value of nothing.
That's it, yeah.
And now, from there, I'm particularly interested in those who have at least shown up, the Occupy Wall Street movement, the people, Bill McKibben's group that shows up.
Yes.
But I see them showing up, but I do not see them being honest or not honest. I think they're extremely naive about the evil
that they believe
will change, because they're showing up with some nice posters, some nice statements, some positive people like Robert Kennedy Jr., and I see nothing good coming from that. But I want you to address...
Well, that goes back to what we were saying about liberalism, isn't it? That liberalism has a completely inadequate understanding of tragedy and evil. So it really fosters airy-fairy fantasies of transforming impossibly difficult situations by theatrics. And that's what the young have been doing largely in Occupy. To imagine that you're going to unseat a death machine that is brilliantly organized, that is filled with power on every level, that has control of the media, of politics, by not having a program, not having a sustained spiritual practice, not having a way of coherently organizing yourself. I mean, this is craziness. And we saw where it led to.
Yes. There is irony to this, in that we have to separate out the Occupy Wall Street movement's enthusiasm, and there was a great deal of that, but compare that to being motivated to be there because of divine inspiration or sacred duty. And I'm sure that
that to the civil rights movement.
Yes.
Occupy lasted, 2-3 months, and it had some very important effects, which were salutary. It did make the 1% publicly available, I think. That was important. It did voice rage at the craziness of the inequality between the rich and the poor, and it did at least boost the spirits of people who had long ago despaired of any Americans under any circumstances saying anything against the corporate nonsense. So all of those things I think we have to salute Occupy for.
I do.
The truth is that if you compare it to the civil rights movement or the movement against the British Empire for Indian independence of Gandhi or Solidarnosc or the movement in South Africa against apartheid, it had none of the moral intensity, none of the sustaining power, none of the ability to risk one's life and put one's whole world on the table to secure the future. It was a kind of theatrical vaudevillian representation of a stab at revolution, almost as if it was created for the cameras. There was something weird and surreal about it, which reflects, I think, the weird and surreal collapse of the American psyche. Does that make any sense to you?
It makes a great deal of sense. Let me be very specific. I had worked with people in my audience, about 6,000 to 8,000 listeners, marched from New York down to Washington over a more than 10-day period, and we met in Lafayette Park. There were a lot of organizers from different groups, all protesting genetic engineering, and Jeffrey Smith and many people from Consumers Union all worked together. I was doing a discussion outside the White House, and one block away from where we were was the Occupy movement in a park. So I went over there and I said that, would you like to come over and speak to our group? And no. So I went to another person and another and another and another. And I said, we have food. We have, would you like to share? No. And then there were a group in this so-called assembly, and they, you know, one would talk, they would all talk. And I said, could I sit in on this? Well, who are you? Why are you here? And I said, I'm just trying to create some some solidarity. We're here to protest genetic engineering, and I believe that because of your position on globalization and Monsanto, that you would like to know what we're doing. We have literature, and we invite you to come over and listen to the talks going on. Not interested. And
why?
What? Because there's just they were not allowing any adults in the room. Okay. This that leads me to this whole concept, and this has really concerned me. The faux spirituality that has become prominent in the Western spiritual marketplace.
And oh my God! Then let's get that is catastrophe.
It is, but I have to get this out because
no one
talks about this.
I talk about it all the time. It is one of the things that I cannot stop talking about, the way in which our contemporary New Age spirituality is really a corporate-sponsored agenda to render us even stupider and more passive in the face of overwhelming violence and craziness.
But it's not just here. It's also rampant throughout India. In your own life, you went through a difficult period with a certain guru that resulted in you pretty much renouncing the guru model and its connections with money and power. And today, most institutional religions and its leaders have betrayed their followers, and the younger generation has been completely betrayed. Yeah. So in your view, how has religion betrayed us? And as an alternative, what should spirituality be today? And shouldn't we even redefine spirituality from what we have been led to believe? And I trust none of these gurus and none of the spiritual teachers in America, because I've seen that they're really commercial spiritual movements. They're in it to commodify. They're in it to make their money.
Yes.
The Tony Robbins phenomena, the Deepak Chopra phenomena. Give me your view on this, please.
Well, I think that the New Age is a corporate-sponsored attempt to keep the American people utterly futile, passive, supine in the face of environmental degradation and the collapse of all of the American institutions. I think that it is a kind of equivalent to allowing drugs in and pretending that we're keeping them out. The New Age is a massive injection of crack into the mystical veins of America at the moment when authentic mysticism, authentic understanding of the spiritual path is as precious as oxygen. So it's been a complete disaster in almost every way, especially in the way in which it has celebrated malignant narcissism as a way of connecting with God. You turn up, you ask for a McMansion or a Mercedes-Benz or for a fabulous girl or boy, and of course God gives it to you because you're doing your manifestations right. This is insanity in the face of an exploding world. And millions and millions and millions of people's souls and minds and hearts have been polluted by it, and I find it appalling and deeply saddening and a great block to authentic teaching. I think we've come to the moment where the religions have failed completely because they have not mobilized humanity in the face of a massive threat, not only to itself, but to the whole of nature and the whole continuation of the human experiment on Earth. And that alone would be enough to show how idiotic their tribalism and their self-absorption and their fanaticism are. But then when you heap on that the fact that most of the religions have retreated into fundamentalism, and that you have in the Middle East a madman in Iran who believes that the 12th Imam is going to crawl out of a well if he plunges the world into nuclear war, a well he's been in fundamentally, you know, for 1100 years, so he must be getting pretty lonely down there. You have Netanyahu, who is playing with the right-wing idiots in the Jewish assembly who truly believe that the Messiah will come and this Armageddon comes, and you have the whole madness of the fundamentalist Christian right who are in bed with the fundamentalist Jewish right who believe that Jesus is about to appear when everything is running in blood. So you have a situation where the religions are not only not mobilizing humanity, but they are contributing in fundamentalist lunacy to the single most dangerous crisis in the planet that could possibly be the foundation of a third world war that would almost certainly start from one or other of those religious fanaticisms. This is an appalling crisis. what I have discovered in my own life is that despite official religion, a few very brave people in each religion found very authentic paths to divine presence and to incarnating and embodying that presence in the core of their lives. And these are the great pioneer mystics, and what they founded in each of the great traditions are largely secret mystical traditions, which are now absolutely essential for us, because what essentially a mystical tradition is not a set of dogmas, but a set of scientific understandings of the stages and stations that you go through as you are transformed from a human being into a divine human being. This knowledge is priceless, and I've spent my life studying Christian mysticism, Hindu mysticism, Buddhist mysticism, indigenous mysticism, and finding the deep parallels between them, because I think what is being born now is what I would call a universal mysticism, which isn't a mysticism that just denies all the different religions. It's a mysticism that says to us, very, very simply, the universe is created out of divine light. It is the dance of the divine light. It is all utterly, completely, wholly sacred. The body is as sacred as the soul. The heart is as sacred as the mind. The universe is a marriage of opposites, and the whole point of being on the earth is to embody the divine by uniting the opposites inside you. And there are these paths that can help you do this, and there are these practices that can sustain you as you take the tremendous journey that will empower you directly from the divine. That's the new humanity. That's here now. There have been many people working on it. I've been one of them. And we do have on the earth in the last 30 years all the treasures of all the mystical traditions. But even more importantly, we have all the sacred technology, the meditation systems that were kept hidden are now being revealed. Because at this moment, when religion is contributing to the crisis, we're tempted to abandon all relationship to the spirit, which would, of course, just make the crisis immeasurably more disgusting and forbid us from finding the true marriage of inner and outer that sacred activism challenges us to. But the great hope is in the survival of the mystical revelations that point to this unified force field and the spilling out of the ancient technologies of transfiguration hidden in the mystical systems that can now be used by anybody sincere. This is a big revolution, and it's here, and we can take full advantage of it when we come to understand just how sacred and important it is.
I appreciate those insights, because you've given us an understanding of the difference in interpreting myths and symbols very literally that spiritual people today and those who consider themselves awake to social issues are intelligent and more scientifically methodological in their mindsets. So adverse to referring to something as evil or demonic. And in all the great spiritual literature during the past several thousand years, we discovered evil and darkness as a clear metaphysical and psychological force. It's capable of committing astonishingly bad acts. However, to call something evil is considered not postmodern, or it's unevolved. So we should psychologize evil out of existence, and hence, without that understanding of the power of evil, how it's manifesting, how in the world are reasonable people supposed to address it?
Well, I think that you're hitting on something absolutely central to our dereliction. At the moment when evil is having a massive worldwide orgy, you have the majority of spiritual teachers denying the existence of evil. This is a masterpiece of evil itself, isn't it? I think people are terrified of the word evil because they're terrified of two things. They're terrified of recognizing that what we call evil may be part of the one. It must be part of the one. You can't have a vision of the total divine as being a unified force field without recognizing that terrible and destructive and ferocious and appalling things happen in that force field as part of the alchemy of that force field. So they must be part of the one. So God must have a dark side. We've made God into limitless light alone without looking at the very ways in which God manifests through the ferocious dance of opposites that necessitate destruction and chaos and horror and what we call evil. So that's the first slap to our naivete. And the second slap to our naivete is that if you face the evil the darkness, the dark forces in the very unified force field itself, you've got to start looking at the ways in which you yourself are vulnerable to them. You yourself serve them while pretending to serve the good. You yourself are hypocritical and slothful and vain and conscripted by the cultural desire for success and all the rest of it, and become, whether you like it or not, in choosing passivity and in choosing consumerism, a willing participant in a huge black mass orgy of massive worldwide destruction. So it's very convenient to say evil doesn't exist, because if you were to face the full range of its activities in the world and then face the full collusion of your own unlooked at, unhealed shadow in the full range of those activities, you would have 17 nervous breakdowns and have a chance of becoming a human being in this crisis.
I appreciate your final thoughts. We're out of time. Thank you very much, Andrew Harvey, for being on and sharing some enlightened insights with us.
Thank you so much, Gary, for the work you do.
Andrew Harvey, internationally renowned religious scholar, graduated and taught at Oxford University as a fellow at All Souls College, Cornell University, California Institute of Integral Studies, and his website is andrewharvey.net, his latest book, Radical Passion. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you for listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour.